Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is Good Humans Podcast with me, Cooper Chapman, chatting to the world's best about the inspiring stories that got them to where they are today. What's going on, you good humans? Welcome to a very fun guest episode of Good Humans Podcast. This is guest episode number 85 with Bonnie Hancock. Bonnie is an absolute legend, and you're going to love this story. If it's your first time tuning in, whether you're on YouTube for the first time ever right now, or you are on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please make sure you hit that 5-star rating, and please go and hit that like and subscribe button. As much as it sucks having to say that every time, it really does help this podcast move up, and I thank you all for tuning in. A massive thank you as well to our sponsors, Drink Arepa. Arepa is a brain function drink. They truly do make our brain perform at a higher level. Developed by neuroscientist, Bonnie loves it. She is a dietitian, so you're going to hear her talk all about how important it is to her. But also, if you do want to get a discount off this product, you can head to the link in the show notes. Use the code GOODHUMAN. You get a massive 25% off. Take care of your brain. Grab some Arepa. They support this podcast massively and myself, and I'm sure you're going to love the product. All right, on to this episode. Bonnie has a crazy story. Bonnie was an Iron Woman in the surf, ski, swim, paddle races in Nutrigrain and a few of those series here in Australia. But the thing that blew me away that's going to absolutely blow your mind is what world record she just set. She paddled a surf ski around Australia. So think Ned Brockman's record running across Australia. She paddled the whole way around Australia, 254 days. Absolutely unbelievable. She was doing between 8 and 14 hours of paddling every single day, which just doesn't make any sense to me. Kilometers out to sea, couldn't see land for a lot of the trip. And yeah, she broke that world record. And the best thing about it, she did it raising money for Gotcha for Life, a mental health organization who is doing some amazing things in the industry. So she raised over $100,000, which is just incredible. She's also a dietitian, and now she is working as a coach for the Nippers at Mermaid Surf Club. I absolutely love this chat. I'm sure you're going to love it too. If you do get something out of it, please make sure you do a little story on your Instagram. Tell a friend about it. If it's going to inspire someone else in your group, make sure you tell them about it. It's always good to be able to bounce ideas and share things that we get benefits out of to our friends. So please do that. Let's jump straight into it. Welcome to Good Humans Podcast. Bonnie Hancock, how you going, Bonnie?
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very well. Another start to the week. So I actually did my first race on the weekend in a while, so a little bit sore today.
Oh, no way. Where'd you race?
So we raced, well, actually, we were supposed to race at Manly on Saturday, and there was a shark sighting, and the shark had attacked a dolphin. And then a bit later, they found a body of someone who'd gone missing. So the whole carnival was cancelled. But the next day, we had a different race at Freshwater. So Saturday was drama filled, and yeah, it was quite a roller coaster of a day, really.
Wow, that's super interesting. I heard about that on the news, actually. I heard someone talking about that. There was like a bunch of sharks, like, was it attacking a dolphin or something? Yeah.
Yes.
At Shelley.
Yeah, literally, it's Shelley Beach. So just around from Manly, and we had all of our tents, all of our craft line up at Manly. You know, hundreds, really thousands of competitors. I just got out of the warm up and I heard the siren go off. And then I saw the chopper overhead and they said, everyone get out of the water. It was like something off a movie. Everyone raced out, and over at Shelley, you could see the whole beach lining up, and it filtered through quickly that there was a big shark out there that had attacked the dolphin. I think it's bitten its dorsal fin. So the dolphin was struggling, and then there were other sharks that came, and this chopper floated over and a second one came. So, well, we knew it wasn't good, and they had to close the beach for 24 hours for safety.
Wow. Yeah. That's a crazy weekend that you've been through, but hey, here we are in a new week.
Exactly.
And today is all about getting to know your story. The question I do open all of my podcasts with is, what are you grateful for right now?
Oh, I'm grateful for community. And at the moment, we're right in the peak of our surf life saving season. I've just come back after my paddle, which we'll get into. And I'm coaching the Nippers at Mermaid Beach Surf Club. And I race in the seniors. So the surf club, I live just nearby, and just the whole mermaid community, it's so beautiful. I feel like everyone has a place and is valued, whether you want to be a top athlete or just go there to go for a swim or participate. the mermaid community at the moment.
I love the mermaid community. I'm also part of it. I live like literally, you're probably the closest guest I've ever had on. I think you're about a kilometer, not even a kilometer away from me. I live at Mermaid Beach too. And yeah, the community is amazing. I'm sure you go to Rafiki. You've probably seen the little good human gratitude cards at Rafiki before.
Absolutely. That is, yeah, I love the green smoothies at Rafiki. And it's again, we talk about community. You know, you see the same faces there. You get to know people you haven't spoken to prior and, you know, hear about everyone's stories. So, absolutely love the area.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the Gold Coast too. It's been so nice. A big change for me from Sydney, but also a real positive change. I think the community, like you said, is so uplifting. It's like everyone's up early. Everyone's walking along Hedges Ave, going and getting their coffee, getting outside, and that's the sort of life that I want to live. But another thing that I do to open every podcast is share with my awesome guests my awesome sponsor, Drink Arepa. So Arepa is a brain drink. And you're a special person to actually maybe comment on this because not only are you an Iron Woman, a world record holder, but you're also a dietitian. So health and what we put in our body is very important to you, as it should be for everyone. And as I told you off air real briefly, you said you hadn't tried Arepa before. So this is going to be your first time. But neuroscience, brain performance drink developed by neuroscientists, New Zealand neuroberry blackcurrant, L-theanine, and a pine bark extract, no caffeine, all natural. And yeah, it's going to fire up our brains for the chat. So
incredible. We'll crack these open. We will.
A little cheers.
And hands work after paddling on the weekend.
Oh, yeah, I know. You must be a little bit buggered. Anyway, cheers. Pretty strong, but very.
I love blackcurrant, actually.
Well, you're going to love Repa, and I'm going to get you sent some because I'm sure you'll be able to give us some good feedback.
See, that's awesome because I do, as a dietitian, you do see patients, you know, unfortunately down that journey of Alzheimer's, dementia, and the effects it has not only on them but their family. And I think it's so exciting, this sort of thing, this, you know, area of research, and so much research has gone into this product, as you were saying, but something that's really practical and tastes good. And I think you need to look at the practicality for patients and, you know, what are they going to actually enjoy drinking as well that's going to benefit them. So that's a really, really exciting space there.
Yeah, I'm very excited for what's to come. They're going to be bringing Good Humans podcast to everyone's ears this whole year, so I'm very excited about that partnership, but I'm also excited about getting to know your story now. So how I open all of my podcasts, like I told you off air before, is getting to know your upbringing a little bit so it sets the scene to understand why you've achieved what you have achieved, which is incredible, but we'll catch up to there. So where'd you grow up? What was family dynamics like as a kid? And yeah, how was life as a youngster?
Yeah, well, I saw this morning you've had a Barney Miller on your podcast, and he lived down the end of the street from me. So I grew up in Sawtell in New South Wales, actually born in Brisbane. And I've got three sisters. So mum and dad traveled around a lot for work, and our sisters were born in different places. So my eldest sister, Georgia, was born in Sydney. Courtney is 2 years older, was born in Perth, and India, the youngest, was born in Coffs, but born in Brisbane. 2 years there, and then my whole childhood was spent running around barefoot on the streets of Sawtell and at Sawtell Surf Club. So from a very young age, around five, mum and dad, you know, put us into nippers to keep us safe. So we grew up living on the beach and with a track straight to the beach, you know, with the drownings around Australia, it's very important for kids to learn to swim. And I just wanted to do what my older sisters were doing. So I think, I'm not sure, where are you? Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I've got siblings. I've got one older sister, two younger. Grew up in North Narrabeen on the beach, and same thing, from about five or six, got put into nippers for just surf safety.
Yes, exactly. And I was going to say, when you have an older sibling, it's almost like you're watching what they're doing. You want to kind of follow. You look up to them, essentially, and I still really do. So yes, my two older sisters were out there on their boards. I remember taking down my little like boogie board and wanting to paddle out in the back, and mum and dad having to kind of hold me back. And so grew up there, primary school, high school at John Paul College in Coffs Harbour. Had a really, I think, blessed childhood. From probably around the age of 12, I knew I wanted to be a professional Iron Woman. And it was Courtney and I who really stuck with it. So Georgia and Indy were really talented athletes. Georgia was a great runner, national level runner, and Indy was a very good board paddler. But I think Courtney and I were really the ones who had our minds set on the professional Iron Woman side. And we used to watch Carla Gilbert, who was our idol, run around on the telly. So at 17, that's when I made the trip north to the Gold Coast. And you know, you grow up in places like Coffs Harbour, you do your best to train. I had my sisters, but you get to a certain age where you know, moving to, you know, metropolitan area, certainly somewhere like the Gold Coast or like Sydney, they're really the hubs of surf life saving. And just having that squad around you, you go from training with two in your squad to 50. So, yeah. But, yeah, really lucky with a childhood. And my sisters and I, as much as we probably hate to admit it, we've always been, I guess, competitive in that way of when we trained, we were racing each other. And I think that did everything to help me.
Yeah, those sibling rivalries can be so powerful. Watching both you and your sister obviously come up through the ranks in the Iron Woman can be a good motivator, but also a good training buddy, someone that can keep you accountable to really push yourself. I want to rewind real quickly. What was school like for you with high school? You said you knew from the age of 12 that you wanted to be a professional Iron Woman. Quite similar to me. I knew from probably 12, 13, I wanted to be a professional surfer, which I think a lot of people go through high school a bit confused. What am I going to do after school? But for you and myself, that path is kind of set. So what was your sort of views throughout school? Did you enjoy the academic side? Were you always just getting out of school to go train for Iron Woman? What was school like for you?
Bit of both. I love academics. And for me, when I think of school, juggling act, and it always has been. So I loved, you know, English PE, very much history. Ironic, I'm a dietitian now. I didn't enjoy science as much at school, but I love reading. And so for me, it would be cramming in my assignments and study wherever I could. So if there was a free lesson, my friends would be there catching up, socializing. I'm like, I need to use this to catch up on work. So yeah, I, you know, probably took after mum in that area, the subjects I enjoyed, and really, really enjoyed school and really pushed myself. So I've always had that bit of a balance, but I think I also knew I wanted to go to university, and I wasn't sure whether I wanted to study journalism or something within sport. And it was at a couple of, I think I was around 14 when I went to my first athletic camps where we listened to dietitians and physios sort of speak to us and how if you took care of yourself, it would improve your performance. So initially I thought, I want to work with athletes. I want to be a sports dietitian. And that's what I ended up applying for, dietetics. But in the end, I've jumping forward a little more, work in the GP space with average Joes and Janes and people with chronic conditions as well. So really grateful for how that's turned out. But I do love academics, and I still do love study.
Yeah, that's so cool. I think it's special to know that you can now help people along their journeys after having such a stellar career. Something that's interesting about your sport, and we spoke about this briefly off air, is as much as it is a professional sport, Iron Woman, the funding doesn't sound like it's quite there to make it your full-time thing. Most athletes in that space are working jobs at the same time. How hard was it to commit to something that you could make a bit of money from, but also knew you had to juggle, because there is quite a lot of professional sports now where you can focus 100% of your time on it. Yeah. And with Iron Woman, that I can imagine comes with 30, 40 hours a week of training. How did you find that balance once you finished school to be able to make some money, but also be able to chase the dream of being Iron Woman champion?
Yeah, it's an awesome question. And still to this day, almost on behalf of the next generation, I feel frustrated sometimes. I think the tennis players are absolutely incredible. I'm watching the Australian Open at the moment, and you see the checks of like millions of dollars and things. And it's hard to know that as an Iron Woman or an Iron Man, you train 2-3 times a day, like you said, 30, 40 hours. You have to be on that top level. You've got a board leg, a ski leg, a swim leg, and a run leg. Then you're looking at doing your gym. You got to fit in all of your, you know, stretching and massage and that kind of thing too. So you really are working full-time hours as an athlete, but you also need to earn a living. So some of the clubs support athletes in some way, and there's you know, businesses like Shaw and Partners who get behind the Ironman, Iron Woman series, they get behind the Summer of Surf series, and they are doing so much to take the prize money to the next level. And with that, the standard just continues to rise, which is incredible. But the reality is, when I was at uni, I was on my feet waitressing at the surf club, trying to get some money on the side. You know, if you did manage to crack a race win, you're more looking at about $3,000 as your prize money. It's just not enough to carry you through. So, you know, you do it the hard way, and you do it for the love of it. You have to love it. But the silver lining to that is it does force you to find another passion that you've got. So for me, it was dietetics, and that balance of going to the clinic and working with someone with end stage cancer and then going to training, it really puts a good perspective on it. And I always say you want something to come back to on a Monday. So a loss in a race or whatever in the grand scheme of things isn't too much when you're dealing with that sort of population.
Yeah, finding that balance and the perspective must be so eye-opening to see people with eating disorders, people with things that we take for granted to be so easy, really struggling with it. So having that balance of, oh, maybe a little bit like, oh, poor me, why aren't we making more money in sport, to being like, people have got some bigger problems than the problems that I'm dealing with on my day-to-day. So let's talk about your Ironwoman career. Finished school, you're studying at uni, you're focusing a lot on the Ironwoman. How were those first couple of years out of school in your early 20s chasing, and what were some of your biggest results?
Yeah, really tough those couple of years. I remember, moving up 17, and I remember doing the first trial, and it was supposed to be down here on the Gold Coast, and the surf was like that 8 to 10 foot cyclone swell stuff, way too big. So they moved it to Redcliffe, which is the flat, you know, up near Brisbane. And it was a blessing for me because we paddle big 18 kilo surf skis. You know, they're like 6 meters or whatever they are, a little bit longer. They're huge. So for a 17-year-old, I could barely carry the thing, but in the flat water, I could do enough to get through. And I ended up qualifying. I think I finished 7th and 10 got through. There were already six qualified from the year before. And Courtney and I qualified together. And that moment was just incredible up there. And it felt like everything I'd ever wanted, happened. But I really had to work for it. It was an intense boot camp style couple of months leading in, 3 sessions a day. You didn't miss one. Our coach, Pat O'Keefe, had us running up the sand dunes, you know, in the gym, doing everything you can imagine. You didn't pull out early. You did the whole thing. So I think the resilience we had to build growing up in Coffs with, you know, we trained in 15 degree water in the pool in winter because they couldn't afford to heat the pool. We only had each other. So that really helped me, but I realized that whole other level of training. And then we went in and did the series, and I ended up doing 7 seasons of the professional series. It was incredible. I was lucky enough to get some podiums in that time, had a couple of wins in a few different races. But it's funny, we were sort of saying earlier how factors earlier in your life can affect something. It's almost like I felt like I never quite got that big win. And I was so stoked. Courtney got some amazing Nutrirain series titles, and it was incredible. And when I was out there, I was going for her. If it couldn't be me, it was her. But it was like I was always chasing that big title. And there was a season when I was, 24. And I thought, this is my year, this is it. And I had some really promising results. Got 3rd in the Coolangatta Gold, like a 2nd in one of the rounds. And I remember I pushed myself to the point and overtrained and underfueled. My body was giving me all of the signs. I had headaches, you know, something was wrong. But I was so set on that win that I drove myself into the ground, got glandular fever, and had to pull out for the season. And basically wrecked my body where I had to have 2 whole seasons off out of the sport and give it up. And it was as I was coming into the peak, really had the balance of experience and youth. And it just shows I probably didn't have that perspective at that time. I was still finishing my degree at that time, so I wasn't working in the clinics as much. It was a really good learning curve. And I think everything that happened led to what I did just recently. But it was such a hard lesson to learn. All of my friends and social network were within the Ironwoman really scene, and I realized I wasn't investing into myself in other areas, overtraining, social. So when all of that was taken away, I lost all of my identity and had nothing. So it took really 2 years to find that again.
Yeah, wow. There's a few things I want to touch on from that. The first is this power of intrinsic motivation. Obviously, growing up in a smaller town, not having access to the resources that the bigger clubs on the Gold Coast in Sydney have, it would have obviously created such intrinsic motivation for you to know you have to do it yourself, which I'm sure is probably one of the main reasons why that inner voice, when you probably battled it for days on end out when you were doing your paddle, which we will talk about around Australia, world record, that intrinsic motivation, like you said, that self-belief and those values that we get from a young age can have such an impact on our later life. But the other thing I want to touch on, you said your sister obviously had some big results, took out the Ironwoman Championship. I don't know how to question this in the right way, but was there moments where you felt like you're in your sister's shadow a little bit and you weren't quite reaching where you wanted to? Obviously, you're so stoked that she's winning, but were there times where you were like, oh, I just want my year where I have my breakthrough?
I think there can be – the mixed emotions will be around that you're training alongside and you might have
doing the same stuff.
Exactly, where you might have a session and you might, you know, do that effort faster or get out the back quicker and, like, you know, or in the pool you swing the same times and think, why can't I just put that race together? But I think something that Courtney's always been so good at in races is, you know, not overthinking it, you know, which allows you to have a clear mind and make decisions, you know, on the fly and all that kind of thing, which in big surf is, as you know, with your surfing, you've got to make those decisions. What wave are you taking? You know, it's huge. And it's the same for us. Are you going to risk it and run down to the rip and risk running a bit further and sacrificing that time? Are you going to take off on that huge bomb on your ski and hope that you hold it? And I think she's always been incredible at keeping a calm mind under pressure. And maybe when I was younger, I think not having that experience, I did some really silly things. Like there was one race I remember I was winning and I took off on the stupidest wave that no one should ever take on a ski. Ski goes flying and, you know, you end up swimming in, that kind of thing. So it was incredible to see her achieve. I mean, like the wins she got and hard fought wins too. Like she's winning, you know, some of these things, like a cooling gut of gold after 3.5 hours in a sprint up the beach. So the first part of it is I don't think I possibly would have got to be a professional Ironman without her. I definitely don't. I don't think I would have trained as hard growing up, and I don't think I would have had the work ethic that I do, because we were always kind of competing. But then the second part is you probably question in terms of what am I doing wrong, you know, just to get that. And we're talking like we'd have races where like she'd win, I'd come second or like third or that kind of thing, and occasionally it did switch around as well, absolutely. But she was so good at grabbing those big titles because she just did all of the things right in the races too. I feel like I made some really big mistakes in certain races. But if there's anyone who could have won, it was her. And I remember this one particular race and she was going for the title, and we do the eliminator. So it's three races. You start with 18 girls and you knock it down six each time. So it comes down to six at the end. So it's super brutal. You get like a couple of minutes in between each. And I was heading around and I might have been going out in fifth or so, and she's coming back on the other side, like racing a girl, and it's literally for the title. And I remember like calling out, like, oh, like screaming, like genuinely at that stage. Like I'm like, I'll take the fifth, if, you know. So there was plenty of that too. So yeah, I couldn't have got to where I was without her. And you know, when I told her I was doing the paddle, the first thing she was like concerned about my safety and worried, but supported me all the way because she knew I was going to do it. She just didn't like the idea of crocodiles.
Oh, that's crazy. The support you obviously have for your sister, it's really cool that you can look at it with a gratitude mindset and be like, I'm so grateful that she maybe brought me up to a higher level rather than look and go, I wish I was at that level. She elevated me. I think it's a really refreshing perspective to have. And then let's talk about this paddle. So how did it come about? When did the idea come in your mind? And yeah, we can draw this story out because I want to hear about the logistics, which I'm sure were a nightmare. But yeah, the listener, because I'm sure people are probably going, what's this paddle? Do you want to tell us what it was, why you did it? And yeah.
And I think it's a good segue, that last little bit, because I truly think that maybe if I was racing and I feel like I cracked that really big race win, I'm like, I don't actually think I would have done the paddle.
You would have felt fulfilled.
I think so, right? Yeah. Like, you know, so it's such a catch-22.
Nothing to prove.
I truly think that. And I think so. I picked up a book mid-2019. So it was just as COVID was kicking off around the world and was kind of like we'd heard in Italy and China. And
2019
is, I'm trying to think what month it was in the end.
Must have been like right at the end.
Yeah. Mid to late. It was I remember some of the restrictions were starting to be brought in and that kind of thing, or they were concerned. And
it must have been mid to late 2020 then. 2020 was the first year of COVID.
Yeah, 2020, sorry, that I picked it up first. That's right. So 2019 was when we started here. I think it was overseas. Was it end of 2019 when they first started COVID? 2020 in Australia.
Early 2020. I remember I went on a trip with Corona. Hamilton Island in like February. And then my sister got married at the end of February. Yeah. And then we flew home from Bali and then everything got locked down mid-March 2020.
There you go. That's right. So beg your pardon. It was, 2019 that it was overseas. 2020. And I read this book. And it was about Freya Hoffmeister, who was the German woman who paddled around Australia in 2009. And from the moment I picked that book up and really from the first chapter I was in, I'd never, ever had that feeling in my life other than that want to be a professional Ironwoman, like I've got to do this, than this at the age of, into my 30s. To be like, I absolutely have to do this without a shred of doubt in my mind. I was like, for whatever reason, was like I was meant to do it, meant to pick the book up. And it was the third book I picked up. Picked up three. One was Winx and the other one was Shane Warne's book. And then the third one was Freya's book. And even the stories about sharks bumping her and crocodiles stalking her for 100 kilometers, it was like, I got to do that. And for 6 months then, I went back and forth and tried to convince myself why I shouldn't do it. You know, typical like imposter syndrome stuff, like what if I don't do it? What if I spend all of this time and get everyone to back me and then I don't make it, it's a failure? And all of those negatives came in. And I remember first looking at my husband, Matt, and saying, I want to do this. I want to paddle around Australia. I'm reading this book. And he kind of looked at me with a blank stare, like, I think he wasn't sure what to say, right? So it's like, he didn't say anything. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, like he doesn't go silent very often. I said to him, I'll revisit with you in 2 weeks. 2 weeks later, I was like, I really want to do this. I just need to get my head around how it's going to work. And I kind of kept revisiting it for 6 months. And really after 6 months, he's like, you're going to do this, right? Like, and he knew he'd come on board to make it safer. I think he thought I was going to do it anyway. I couldn't do it on my own. And thank goodness he got behind because he ended up managing the logistics.
Wow.
But then started the hustle and really, I took off in 2021 in December. So it was sort of that hustle for a bit over a year. And we realized we just bought our unit. We had minimal savings. We had to sell both our cars. We were both in jobs that we loved. We ended up giving those up. And leaning on everyone we could, making as many connections as we could to get the money to even take off. We really only had money to get halfway around by the time it took off. So,
wow, someone sacrificed. And do you want to explain maybe for people listening what you did? And then we'll talk about some stories throughout. So, you're paddling a surf ski, which is, like you said earlier, a 6 meter kayak. I guess you're not a kayak, a surf ski.
Yes.
But for people who don't know what a surf ski is, it's like a long, skinny kayak and you paddled that thing around the country. What, 12,500 kilometers?
Yeah, absolutely. So Freya did 14,000 Ks. So it had only been done four times before I did it. Freya was the first female and she'd actually done the quickest. So she did in 10 months, 22 days. It's a hard one. It's like, I guess, surfboards, like the different types and everyone's got the type that they enjoy riding more than others. With ours, Surf Life Saving skis are 18 kilos built for going in and out of the surf. An ocean ski is 9 kilos, super lightweight carbon fiber, similar length, so 6 meters, and it's built for downwinds with the run. So like you'll see a lot of the big races of the foils might have an ocean ski section as well. The Molokai particularly, which is a 50K race in Hawaii, which is incredible. So I was paddling a 6 meter, 9 kilo piece of carbon fiber, basically floating carbon fiber. I was the first one to do it clockwise. So I did a lot of research into currents. I spoke to meteorologists. I spoke to super yacht captains. And in the time frame I wanted to do it, which was initially 6 months, which was just ludicrous. I thought I could do it in that and not have to have any weather holdups. The East Australian Current moving north to south down the coast, so it pushes the warm water from the Great Barrier Reef down to Tasmania. The biggest part or the hardest part was, and it was always going to be the Great Australian Bight, whether I hugged the coast or whether I cut straight across. Everyone prior had hugged the coast. you could save 1,000K by cutting across, but it took you 500K out to sea. Oof. 500K out to sea with a 38-foot catamaran next to you is absolutely terrifying. To get across there, you've got to do a lot of night paddling. So I said to people, when you stand on the beach and look at a horizon, it's 40K that you can see. So 500K out is, it's different out there. The water changes. It's even in the daytime, the water's dark. The water's dark. And we got told that there were killer whales in that region, and just to be really careful. I mean, how careful can you be when you're paddling? You just try and keep the speed up as much as you can. Sailors, for them, it's like an initiation of sorts, and they try to get across in a couple of days. We spent 2 weeks at sea getting across with me paddling, and I had to paddle 100K a day because any less or any slower, we already went across 3 weather windows to get there. You risk these big Arctic blows coming up from Antarctica. So, yeah, it's I'm still processing how we did it. And recently I'm actually writing my book at the moment, and I put it off for a couple of weeks diving into that, into the bite. And even when it happened, I couldn't speak about it for a couple of weeks after. But, it's terrifying out there. And once we did that, we felt there's nothing more, you know, the country can throw at us. And it was just after that, you're moving into crocodile territory from Broome right across to Townsville. So it's a whole other form of challenge, and you're risking heat stroke in 40 degrees. You're up in the Kimberley, which is in the Northern Territory, night paddling, where you can literally hear splashes, and they were seeing crocodiles in the water around me. So, there's a bit to unpack.
Yeah, I'm going to rewind and then we're going to get back through it. So I want to rewind to the preparation involved for something like this. The first thing that comes to mind for me is probably something that wouldn't come to mind for most people, but the logistics of it. I know after watching Ned Brockman's thing, Ultra Endurance Challenge, just seeing like the nutrition that's involved in it is crazy, because you're doing 100 kilometers a day, the calories that you're burning, the training involved prior. Let's hit a few things. So let's talk about the logistics first. You said you didn't even have the funding to get the whole way around, but you just went for it. What was involved with the logistics of getting the right boat? Because you obviously have to have someone trail next to you the whole way. Yeah, let's talk about how you started to pull it together.
I'm almost glad I didn't know what was coming. I didn't realize the enormous cost. And finding, you know, a boat and a crew, and finding videographers. I knew I wanted to film it. I knew I wanted to share it, but also excitingly have the footage for a documentary as well. So it was finding the right people. I mean, you were going to be with for 8 months as well. A crew on a boat who would come like and do things like that, like across the bite, like not everyone would do that. Matt really was the driver with all that stuff. So he found our crew. Ben, Blake and Jamie were the core crew. And Jamie works in cinematography and worked on Elvis and has a lot of experience in that way. He came on the boat almost the whole time. And Blake was the other one. And he'd had a bit of experience prior with the camera too. So they came on. They were going to do the filming. Ben was pretty much on land crew the whole time, and he was our jet ski driver. So he, was with Matt on land. That's the other part that people probably don't realize is Matt wasn't actually on the boat. He was on the boat for a month, and for all the bite and all the crocodile stuff, he was on land because we talk about COVID. Now we've got the timeline right. We had to get an exemption to get into Western Australia. So we were always risking getting down here and not being allowed into that state, or being cut off at any state for that matter, because it was literally like, it was like COVID was following us. Like, we wanted to do workshops. So my charity was Gotcha for Life, which is a mental fitness charity. And we wanted to do workshops and speak to communities along the way. We pretty much had to stay at sea all on the East Coast because COVID was hitting Newcastle and Sydney. And if we got COVID and that held us up, Guinness World Records say you've got to keep moving. You can only stop one place for 2 weeks. So like worst case scenario, we had to do a quarantine for longer than that. So logistically, it was ridiculous. And the cost of the boat, and, you know, people say, oh, you had a support boat. I was 100K out to sea most days. So I literally did not come to land really that often throughout the whole thing. And even coming back to land when it finished, it was getting used to cars and people moving and like crossing roads. And when I'd come into land, I'd be really clumsy and dropping things because out at sea, everything moves slowly. There's like no stimulation. It's like the occasional bird and you see albatross out there. It's not small birds. There's nothing.
Time becomes a big illusion, huh?
Exactly. It's crazy. And we didn't have reception for a couple of weeks at a time. So say across the bight, that was 18 days in total, no reception. So it's like a whole other experience. It's a forced disconnect and it can be really healthy to do that. But Matt was on land, always had to think ahead, always had to, you know, think, you know, get those exemptions a couple of weeks prior, just got them in time, had to, when I got to land, we still had 3 days left that we were supposed to be at sea and I had to come into hospital when I finished the bite, get on the IV fluids, and he had to organize all of that. So he was really the savior in that regard.
Wow. Let's talk about day one then. I want to kind of run through this trip. What date did you take off? Where did you take off from?
Yeah.
And yeah, what was that first week of paddling like? And what was like an average day? How long were you paddling?
Yeah.
Were you paddling for a block and then stopping and eating and then a block? Like, yeah, yeah, give us a day in the life.
Absolutely. And I think it's the craziest thing is like I had this perfect plan of nutrition and, you know, I knew I was going to be burning about 10,000 calories a day. And I'm like, hey, we've got all this. We had all of the supplements. Their body science came on board for us. You know, we were very organized in that space. And then day one came, so the 19th of December 2021, I actually got blessed with a northerly on that day. So the biggest fear I had, I knew everyone was going to be coming down the beach at Mermaid, was going to be hit with like a head-on southerly and just be grinding at like 2K an hour. And I was like, I don't know, what do you think she's doing? We got this like 15-knot northerly that picked up to 20 knots as we got to Byron Bay, and I was able to surf all day down. So we got 73K done in the first day.
And how long was that paddling?
So that would have been around, I've got someone with me.
Yeah, it's your team.
Right. Yeah, that's why I always say team. I move about 10K an hour in the flat. I move 11 to 12K with a bit of runs. And at the max, really, I mean, on runners, get up to around 18K, but to hold a consistent pace and really go down with 12 to 13K an hour. So that first day, it was more like cruising, 11, 12K. It would have taken eight, 9 hours with jet ski coming, give me a bit of food. So that was day one. The next day from Byron Bay, onwards, I think it was 80, and by 1 week in, I was up to 100K a day. And people always ask me how you train for something like that. You can't really train for 100K a day. You can't get out there and do 100K paddles. You're going to go in and be injured because you're going to get to the line with, you know, some sort of soft tissue injury or overuse. And certainly when I finished the paddle, I had a bulging disc, which I think was there for probably the last 2 months, to be honest. It's like managing load but also being in the best physical condition going in. So I did a lot of gym work, a lot of core and strength to make sure that I had that sort of base. But I also put on 15 kilos leading in. So that was a deliberate thing I knew I had to do. I knew I was going to lose weight. And sure enough, this is by fluke, by the way. I didn't particularly do any maths in this, but I estimated it might look around about 15. And I lost pretty much spot on 15 the whole way around. So it was the heaviest I'd ever been. I did a couple of races for Mermaid Surf Club leading in, which I'm jumping on like, you know, well above your, you know, athlete kind of weight, and which is different for everyone. And I was just like, oh my gosh. So for the first month until I would have lost about 6 kilos in that first month, I actually felt quite uncomfortable in my ski. And it wasn't until really 2 months in where I started losing towards that like 8 kilos and that I started feeling again like an athlete. And the body just slowly conditioned. So I shouldn't downplay the 80 kilometers, because that was me laying on the back deck, like wincing at the end of each day, while Matt's trying to get the massage gun in. And I'm like telling him to stop because I'm in so much pain. Like your whole body locks up, every muscle, you can feel muscles you never knew you had.
Wow.
And at that stage, that's when there's no, all the media's gone, all the crowd's gone. You're down in the isolation of, you know, somewhere in northern New South Wales and onwards. And then by the time you get down towards Victoria, it's isolated coastline. You're a long way out to sea. And that's where it comes back to the reasons you're really doing it. And if you're doing it for the wrong reasons, you're going to find out, because you're going to, in those times, go to the darkest places, and you're going to know why you're doing it.
Why were you doing it?
Well, it changed. When I started, it was for the selfish reason of a world record. And that's what drove me through the preparation. That's what drove me through probably the first week. But I knew I wanted to do good with it. And it was the Gotcha for Life charity. And it was people reaching out to me. So their aim is for zero suicides. And it was people reaching out from the start to tell me about people they'd lost close to them, struggles they'd had themselves. And I was like, that is all I need to put the first stroke in the water. And I was sort of, if I could get through what I was doing, you know, we build almost like a community of people online following. If I could do what I was doing, then maybe I could inspire someone to keep going in their hard time. That's what became the message, the, I guess we talk about, yeah, intrinsic motivators, yeah. And what, you know, that self-talk. It changed. I would have thought about that record after the first month really a handful of times. You got to do it for a lot more than a record when you're putting your life on the line, your cruise life on the line, and you're that far out to sea.
Yeah, it's so crazy. And it almost, do you think you wanted that world record maybe because you felt like you might have not underachieved, but not reached those heights of the Iron Woman career, maybe like your sister did, and be like, this is where I want to draw my mark. But how many days did you end up out there?
Yeah, 254 days, right? So it's spot on. Like, and I think it's such a crazy one, because in Ironman race, like you look at something like your AFL and, you know, how many you have on a list, basically. In the series, you've got 20 guys and girls in the series. You've got one. That's the champion at the end of each season. Like, it's absolutely crazy. You've got one, right? Not even like a team or whatever. So it is that, like, even from the 1% that make this, you're like 0.00. And we are so hard on ourselves. And it's only in reflection now, I look back, I'm like, oh my gosh, I actually did some really cool things as an Ironman. I'm really proud of that. And, you know, I had race wins at Australian titles and things like that, but you're just so tunnel visioned on that one person that can win that series title. And yeah, absolutely. Maybe that was like, this is my thing. But then soon enough, you're, you know, the cruise spawning sharks next to you down the East Coast. You know, you nearly get near hypothermic near Victoria. You know, scary, scary things that happen. And if you're doing it for that reason of external kind of validation from others, it's going to come out. It makes you ask a lot of really hard questions.
Yeah, I'm like just in awe of what you have done with this crazy goal and this achievement. So now I want to get into like a bit more of the day-to-day so people can understand what you were going through, because it's almost impossible to conceptualize what you actually achieved. But what was the average day looking like for you? What time are you waking up? You said you're burning 10,000 calories. What are you eating? How many meals a day are you having to stop for? It's bloody hard to eat 10,000 calories in a day.
It's so hard.
What was it? What time were you waking up? What was like an average day looking like?
Yeah. It honestly, the first probably month as we made our way down the East Coast, it was pretty standard. Might jump in. It all depended on the wind though.
Yeah.
So we chased the tailwind. So basically if it's going to be windy, so we're looking at that northerly pushing us down, you know, if the wind's not kicking up till later, you might get on the water at 10 o'clock. So, you know, you're sort of having your brekkie later, getting in lots of calories prior. It might look like, you know, poached eggs on toast with some avocado, like those good fats in there into your smoothie. In the end, we were putting things like butter and cream into the smoothie. You know, we were putting, you know, all sorts of things in there, as well as your carbohydrates too. So I guess you're kind of looking at a pretty standard breakfast and then what you can do on top of that. And obviously the one of the most easiest ways is through fats. You know, you can actually afford to eat saturated fats too when you're doing that much exercise. But after one, so pretty standard meals a day. When I was on the ski though, eating in the ski is a whole other story. So I'm paddling all day in the ski. If it's a good wind, you don't want to stop. It's like, you know, you're basically paddling a toothpick to get into the boat, and the skipper has to mark exactly where you stop it's a whole process. You've got to get the ski on. The skipper has to float around and then come back to the spot. So if you want an hour off, that boat could drift like 10, 20 kilometers in that time and have to come back to the spot. So I tried in the end to stay in the ski. So there were days where I was in the ski for 12, 14 hours without getting out. I would eat in the ski. So they would come and basically hold a bucket out and I would grab from the bucket like my lunch pack, which would be things like wraps with chicken and salad. You know, you're trying to get lots of vitamins and minerals in there. You know, there would, if I needed a quick little hit of sugar, there might be a couple of lollies in there if I felt my blood sugar starting to go. Lots of chopped up fruit, you know, things like crackers, things that were really easy to digest. So sometimes if you're in a ski all day and you don't have the opportunity to go to the toilet, you don't want things that are super high in fiber. So like your Vitaweeks and things might be out. But once we got to Victoria, I got started getting seasick. And that's when it all changed. So what went from like 6 to 8 kind of smaller meals a day that I could hold down, thinking about what do I need more of, carbohydrates, getting my we had Voost supplements as well with Body Science. So Voost, like do ones with calcium, iron, all of the electrolytes in them, giving my body exactly what it wanted. Once I started getting seasick, I brought everything up. So when I started getting seasick, I would have this beautiful, you know, breakfast of a smoothie, you know, in a nice anchored, calm waters of a smoothie where we put all that extra stuff in, put some avocado in there for some extra fats. As I said, your butter, your cream, you know, your coconut cream, take off, head back out to the spot I'd stopped the day prior, maybe 10K out to sea. And for people who've been on boats, it's like being on a roller coaster. When it's choppy, you are up and down. And if you get seasick, everything comes up. And not even just brekkie. It's like dinner the night before.
Stomach whining.
Everything. Exactly to the point where you've got literally acid reflux. So the most distressing thing was being able to plan all of these things and for the first month have this plan and make sure you were meeting even your basic food groups. And then after 1 month, all of that going out the window, but still having to paddle that same amount. So that's what happened in the bite. The reason I lost that weight, and I lost 8 kilos in 2 weeks of body fat, basically, and a bit of muscle, was because not only did I have nothing in my stomach, I was still burning that extreme amount of calories. So by the time I got to the other side, I was so dehydrated, I could actually barely walk by the time I came into hospital and, you know, had not eaten a proper meal in 2 weeks. So it had to at sometimes go to just what could you keep down? You'd firstly try to keep down a wrap, bring it up. Then you'd go to chop apple, bring it up. And then you'd finally go to something like your Hydrolite or like a Body Science, like shake. And then once you brought that up, you just had to get in your ski and keep going.
Far out. It just sounds like torture that you put yourself through and so many challenges that people wouldn't even expect when they hear, oh, I should paddle around Australia. That's epic.
Yeah.
But it's like all these challenges that you faced would have just been unbelievable. So you've come around the bite. You got to go up the west coast of Australia.
Yeah.
What's the west coast like? Obviously, that time of year, the northerly, when you took off the northerlies to start the year off are pretty common.
Yeah.
Weather patterns in WA are a little bit different to over here. How was that leg, the long straight of over in WA? And are you like coming into land a bit more often once you're over on the WA coast?
Yep. So our boat, our cat had to go back to Queensland and we had to find another boat over there. So it was sort of this time of, I guess it was nice. We had the jet ski and we were able to come to land more often, but there's a lot of Western Australia that's really remote. And I'm glad you said the word long because that state feels like it goes on forever. Like it is the longest, the biggest state when you look at it. And it is so diverse from bottom to top. Like bottom, I'm wearing thermals, like a jacket. I've got a beanie on. I'm rounding that southwest corner and then I'm coming up. And by the time you get to around Perth, it's flat. It was flat. So we sort of got pushed up with the northerlies, like you said. What are we looking southerlies at there? Yeah, yeah. Southerlies, beg your pardon. It's so funny that too, because as I went around, I would have to change my way of thinking. I was like, oh my gosh, your tailwinds now are coming from, you know, the easterly or then your southerly, right? That. So getting pushed up with the southerly and then it went flat around Perth. But then you come into the areas, the big sharks. And I mean, when you're paddling around those areas of like Margaret River region, you may be 50, 100K out to sea and then coming in a little bit further.
So you can't see land?
No, 100K out to, I reckon 40K, from you said probably about 50. From probably about 50K onwards, you really can't see land. And I'm talking like right around, like 360. Yeah. So if that support boat isn't there, I'm looking around with no navigation and can't see where you're going. The only thing that could give you an idea would be the way the runners are going. And that's only if you know
the wind
way,
direction.
Right? The wind direction.
And so the sun?
Exactly. And the sun to some degree. And you've got to stay on top of that because that changes as well. So by the time you get over to Western Australia, you've got these incredible sunsets over the ocean. And that's just something that's spectacular. Mm. But then the way the ocean's, the sun setting is changing on what angle it's and on as well, paddled, right? Yeah. So the whole thing, it's really, really trippy. And you had to, I constantly kept thinking of the map and imagining myself and where I was in the map as I was making my way around. And I would every couple of days when I had reception, check on my phone and see our little dot where it was moving. But then if I did that too much, I'm like, we're literally going nowhere. And I've got this whole thing to do. But once the boat left, we had to stay in close because we had jet ski. And the furthest we went out with the jet ski was probably 20K. So we were probably doing more kilometers, a little bit more weaving. But it was a nice experience with the boys. We got a lot of amazing footage. Coral Bay, Ningaloo is an incredible part of the country. It's clear water, turtles, and there's whale sharks. We didn't run into one. But when we got to the top, that's when it kind of got serious again. We were fortunate enough. We only ran into one great white near Perth. I should think I'm just casually say that. It was one of the last days we had our cat. And I was paddling. I was probably 200 meters behind the boat. And we always had someone on Bonnie watch. There was always someone on the boat who was watching me. And at this stage, it was Jamie, and he was watching me. And he saw the fin. He said he thinks it was a great white come up right next to me. And I'm just paddling along, got waterproof headphones in, and then did this deep dive under my ski and disappeared. And as we know, one of their ways of attacking. And so he's watching and he's telling me to come into the boat. And I'm just like, yeah, yeah, like I'm coming, like I'm getting there. Like I'm thinking he's calling me in for a feed or something. And this whole time he's like, I'm like, oh, his body language actually looks really serious. I'll paddle in. It was when I got on the boat, they told me. So I was tunnel vision this whole time. So stuff was going on around me. And there was another one in the Kimberley where they saw a crocodile out to the side. And I just had no idea. So it's like something off Jaws with like the water skier and the fins like in the background. But when we got to the Kimberley, we linked up with another boat, the Cruising Kiwis, a family who were traveling the world. And they took us through and some of the scariest waters you could ever think to paddle in. Remote, like we made the joke that if you murdered someone out there, no one would ever know. There's just nothing around. So for hundreds of kilometers, you see no soul, other souls, no boats. And we were on a little cat and we had to get some fresh fruit and water from these big cruise ships we ran into because you start running low. And I'm paddling out there in 40 degrees and, you know, I would occasionally fall off too. So when I got really tired, I'd fall out. You're falling into the waters where potentially there's crocodiles in and you're trying not to splash too much as you get back into your ski and things like that. It's like, yeah, it's a really interesting place you've got to take your mind to get into that water every day, knowing what's in there.
Yeah, wow. I'm just like trying to wrap my head around like the head noise that you must have been going through. Were you listening to music or listening to podcasts or books?
Yeah.
What were you doing to fill your head? Because if you're doing 8 hours a day, you listen to a whole new book every single day.
Right, exactly.
And a knowledgeable person on the planet after paddling for 250 days.
I made the joke of like, I'm going to learn French or something along the way. But I tried to listen to that stuff at the start, but it was almost too slow or required too much kind of. I had to focus more. So honestly, I got into Stormzy, Eminem, like cracked on that, like heavy rap, like all day. And sometimes I would take the headphones out. And I'd still have that, like, oh, whatever it's called, like reverberating basically in my eardrum. And there was even a time I was listening to so much music. I remember listening to a bit of Vance Joy. I would sometimes bring it down a bit more cruisy. And I didn't have my headphones in. I was like, is someone playing music on the boat? And they were like, no. I was like, no, I can actually hear him singing. I'm like, it's Vance Joy, like, this quiet, there's nothing on the boat. So like 14 hours of things like banging in your ears, you start hearing things. But I had to do that. I had to really, almost like I said, everything I've ever done is channeled into that. Like every foot I'd ever stepped on the line as an Iron Woman, every line I'd ever stepped foot on is a better way of putting it, isn't it? Every line I'd ever stepped foot on, every training session I'd done, everything I had done in my professional career and in my life led to that moment of getting in the ski and really taking on, essentially taking on crocodiles, because you knew they were in there. And there were certain times they'd be told, do not go near this island. Like the skipper's getting told, avoid that place, avoid that place. But we had to bypass the place because it was in our direct line. Keep the speed up, keep moving. And the other thing with crocodiles is they follow patterns. So the reason they tell people don't go down and fill your water bottle up, you know, in these holes, that's more for the freshwater ones, but they'll watch. And so if they see someone do something twice, it's on the third go that they'll get you. So the thing was to keep moving quickly and never stop in one place for longer than a day if we had to anchor. And apparently when you drop anchor, they come up and have a look at the boat. So for that whole bit, all you wanted to do was jump out and go for a nice swim. You don't go in the water. And I was having to get in there. And when I did fall out, I remember I would always have to stay calm, because if I was splashing and thrashing trying to get back in my ski, that's the kind of thing that draws them. So I'd just try and chill and get back on, and then you get going again. But
and that was a month along the whole top of the northern part of Australia, along Northern Territory,
yeah,
top of Queensland.
Yeah.
And so that was a month of every day, the anxiety you must have carried. Was there any days that you just woke up and you're like, conditions are all good, but I'm just not in a headspace to paddle today?
So many times by the end, like really, and that's what I mean. You like, you've got to have the best reason for doing it. Like you don't even feel like you're in a race or anything with the person who's done it prior. Like I was saying, if anyone ever does this again, I'm going to help them every step of the way. It comes down to survival. And there was a lady who attempted it, who got to the Northern Territory and had to bail out because these big crocodiles were following her. So, it becomes more about doing it for a really good reason. And I tell you, by the time we got to Townsville, I didn't actually realize how much it had affected me with the crocodiles until we got to Townsville, and I all of a sudden felt like we are safe again. And, you know, essentially you can see them kind of down to Mackay. But that's when I knew it was those waters. So essentially a third of the coastline, you can run into a crocodile. And then we started seeing humpback whales, which was incredible and felt like a reward for what we'd been through as well.
Yeah, wow. So you're around that top part of Australia and you're on, I guess you call it the home straight, even though from the northern tip of Australia down to Mermaid Beach is a very long way. It's interesting, isn't it? Like from Cairns to Brisbane is the same as Brisbane to Melbourne.
Yes.
Even though you look at a map, you're like, oh, Cairns to Brisbane, both Queensland. But
yes.
Yeah, it's such a long way. So what's going through your head once you get around that northern tip and you're kind of starting to beeline it for home?
Yeah.
And what, you've probably still got a month and a half left to get back home?
Absolutely. It was relief because just prior to that, to get to that tip, we had to cross the Gulf of Carpentaria. So initially taking it back those couple of years when I was planning, I looked at the map of Australia and you see two bits where you know are going to be the biggest problems, the Great Australian Bight and the Gulf of Carpentaria. And the Gulf, if you went down and underneath again, it's about 1,000 more K than cutting across. So it was our next open ocean stretch. And I knew the seasickness I'd been through. And I was like, people are like, you know, you'll get your sea legs. It's not good. It was just as bad. I don't want to say worse. They're on par, because across the Gulf, we got the southeasterly trade winds. So I was in the open ocean paddling, vomiting again, but we actually got headwinds. The time of year we came through, really in hindsight, it was horrible, but you're going to get headwinds either way you go around. So getting them towards the end, at least I was conditioned and in a better state. 14 hours a day. It was the first time I did 200 kilometers. I did 213 kilometers in the Gulf, I did 173. And by the time I got to the tip, I did 213 at the very top of the country.
In a day.
So I stayed in my ski all day and did that. And basically the reason why I did it, other than getting a record for the 24 hours, basically it was safety. So the skipper would come and tell me, if we don't get to this next island, which is 210K away, we're stuck there for a week because the wind patterns change in certain sections of the coast. So we said, we don't get there. There's 30 knot winds coming. We've got nowhere to anchor and we're stuck. So it all of a sudden became more desperate even than the tailwinds. So you're pushing all day for 24 hours, knowing that if you don't get there, you're in big trouble. So there's no choice. So once I thought the hardest part had been done, when we rounded that top of the country, we got southerly. So the last 2 months of the paddle were headwinds. So this is the whole way around. There were different challenges. And even when we got past the crocodile, it was headwinds. I was like, it just made me earn every single kilometer that I did. There was just no hiding. There was just nowhere to go. You had to face it head on. And I said something like in a post I did not long ago about how you can't come back from something like this the same, because it takes you to places. It forces you to face everything out there.
Yeah. What were you saying in your head on those days that you wanted to give up? What was the driving factor to keep you moving?
You've come too far to back out now. Everything, if you deserve it, you owe it to yourself to finish. You owe it to others and you owe it to your crew to finish. And there was a time very early in the paddle, about a couple of weeks in, where I wanted to quit. It was around Port Macquarie. And it was when we started doing the 100K day. So I'd come up to 100, but my back was still not holding up well. And I wanted to pull out. I remember promising myself, I said, just get to a month. And if you get to a month, you're down in Victoria. It's, again, extrinsic factors. Like, it's less embarrassing. You won't be as much of a failure. And I told myself, get to a month and then see. And when I got to that month, I didn't want to let my past month self down. So I get to one more month, and then it became every 1,000 kilometers. But by the time I got to far North Queensland, I was like, there is no way I am backing down from this. And in what would normally take me, you asked before how long it would take certain things. So I might have done 120K in 12 hours. I went to doing 60K in 12 hours. Oof. So a harder 60, to the point where I wouldn't have been able to pick that cup of water up. My hands were pretty much locked like that. So holding the paddle all day, they were swollen like twice the size. And it's really only been in the last month I've gotten the feeling back after the joints and everything were horrific. So couldn't open doors, couldn't drink out of cups. My crew had to do everything for me.
Yeah, that's kind of the last little question before we get to the finish line. I want to chat about what sort of injuries did you carry throughout the thing, and what sort of recovery did you have on the boat, on the land? Yeah. Because as we know, as athletes, as much as the hard work's important, the recovery is important. And when you don't have time to heal and time to recover, it's really difficult. So what were you doing to recover each afternoon? And yeah, how'd you get going each day? Was it like the first 10Ks each day really hard? I remember listening to a bunch of Ned Brockman stuff, and he sounded like that first 20Ks each day for him was just so hard to get the body warmed up. Was that pretty similar for what you were going through?
Oh, 100%. Like, I felt like I was saying like a 90-year-old woman, like when I started. So I learned pretty early on that I was never actually going to feel good. The only time I'd feel good would be the first day after a lay day, and the lay day would be a forced lay day again from like 30 knot winds or something. That was the only day you'd feel good. So of the whole 254 days, there were a couple of days I felt good, maybe the day paddling out from Mermaid. So as an athlete and on that professional level, and you'll know this, you do everything you can to, you know, feel good and, you know, work on those little things like your flexibility and work on things like, you know, getting the massage and all of that kind of thing, your food. But I learned early on that I actually wasn't going to feel good. And it was such an interesting mindset to get into, because the furthest I'd raced or paddled for this was 50K in the Molokai. Racing that, you feel tapered and primed to do it. This was like getting in the water after your body was shot. So even when I did that 213, like, I had to get back in, you know what I mean? So it's like you just can't recover in that time. And I felt my back getting worse and worse to the point where like something's actually wrong. And when I got back and the physio's like, you have a bulging disc, you need to stop. You know, I was like, thankfully I'm done. But it was just like agony, like for anyone to push. I was like, nah, there's something not right. And the other one definitely was the fingers. And I was like, I feel as though I've got arthritis. Like I feel as though this is what it feels like. And I remember Matt asking me the question in Cairns, so it was not far from home. And he said, if you had permanent injuries from this, would it still have been worth it? And I said, yes, without hesitation. Because again, it was yes, if I can help someone or a certain population or a group of people, help them through, you know, whatever their equivalent of their paddle around Australia is, then it would all have been worth it. So there was a lot of sacrifice, but I didn't even see it as, I just saw it as a necessity to get it done. And I wanted to quit early on, but never really did I ever think I was actually going to back out of it. Because from the moment I picked up that book and the moment I head out from here, I knew I was going to do whatever I could to get it done. I was going to have to be dragged away, you know. And I did get carted off to hospital, but it was going to take a really serious something to happen to stop me. And that was my biggest fear. I was like, I will be out here doing this. Please let something not happen. Like,
yeah.
Tearing something.
And you got to, just real quickly, when did you go to hospital? Was that after the Great Australian Bite when you needed the
bite? And I could barely walk in. I remember feeling so weak as I walked in, got a couple of liters of the IV fluids, all the electrolytes and everything pumped in. I walked out and felt a lot better. But an interesting one of that, COVID was so rife in WA and they were so strict on it. I came out, had to get in the to the ambulance and had police escorts to the hospital, which I don't know where they thought I was going, but that's how strict it was. And the crew couldn't get off the boat. So yeah, logistically, Matt was facing all these challenges. And when we were crossing the bight, all he could see was yellow dot from the tracker on the boat for 2 weeks in his own quarantine, watching that, no communication. Wow. So.
It's crazy. I still can't really comprehend what you achieved. It's unbelievable. So let's just talk about now finishing. Yes. Did you do like Brisbane to Gold Coast in one day? Is that kind of the last distance?
It's about the distance we were paddling, thankfully. So I got given the 28th of August as the day, right? Coming back to the Gold Coast, that was the day they were setting up for the finish. We were going to have Seven Sunrise was there. So it's like 28th of August, got to get back. And these headwinds, I'm like grinding. I'm like, okay, all I want is one day off before the finish so I can greet everyone and at least like, you know, be half human, not like come off the back of like a 100K day. So I ended up getting that day, but I had to work hard for it. So we did Brisbane into Strati and basically anchored up there. And it was an incredible day. I had a couple of, had my sister join me, had a couple of the people from the surf club come and paddle with me for a bit. We went to dinner with the crew because we were trying to kind of keep it low key that we were around. So yeah, basically hanging there. And then on that last day, I paddled out through the spit and back down. Wow, just there. So I did like 11K on the last day or whatever it was. And it was really, really cool. But the funny part is I was trying to get there in time for the interview in the end and it was a bit of a rush, but probably the most beautiful moment was the last couple of K into Mermaid Beach. And I had some of the nippers from the surf club come out and join me, like the next generation and these little girls and these little boys. And that was really, really special. And, you know, it's even now, like every time I love these chats because I kind of bring up something new from the past and in the process of writing at the moment, it's also almost that process of healing. And I know for what a lot of us went through across the bite, as I said, I couldn't even talk about it for a couple of weeks and it was incredibly scary, but it was again a necessity. It had to be done. And if anyone ever does it again, I'll have all sorts of advice for them, the things that I learned along the way. But it's an incredible personal journey too.
Yeah, wow. You should be so proud. So you ended up coming in at 254 days, 250.
254 days. So a
bit, and that was the world record, yes, yeah? So yeah, congratulations on the world record. Thank That's you. Just phenomenal. And like you said, for doing it all the right reasons. After the paddle, you'd raised over $100,000 for Gotcha for Life, which is just incredible to be able to donate to such an important cause. Obviously, mental health is something very important to me. What the crew, Gus Warland, and the whole team at Gotcha for Life are doing such incredible things in the mental health industry. How important or how special was that for you to know that not only did you achieve a world record, but you raised over $100,000 for a mental health charity? And I'm sure you dealt with all the mental health challenges under the sun with literally under the sun over those 254 days. So yeah, what did it mean to you to be able to raise so much money?
It was, yeah, and it was really an ironic thing because, you know, prior to that, it was sort of my experience with, you know, we talk about that loss of identity and everything, and I could see how someone could sort of spiral into that, you know, and then it was through COVID seeing the effect of the isolation on people. But ironically, it was through this journey that there was isolation, you know, there was uncertainty, there was all of those things that people feel and struggle. And I feel like, you know, the paddle can almost be used as that bit of an analogy, and so many messages within it, things I learn about myself means I can, you know, speak freely to people about that. And it's amazing what Gus has done. I mean, he started Gotcha for Life when he lost a close friend to suicide, and you really feel and see his passion and how he speaks. And that just increases my passion even further. And I think we all need to prioritize it, because it's not ourselves, it's someone close to us. You know, it's one in five at any given time struggling. So, you know, statistics are there. They were climbing through COVID, and you know, there is some incredible people like yourself doing some amazing work in that area. And I'm just, yeah, really grateful if I can, yeah, make a small drop in the ocean in that area. And it would all have been worth the struggle.
Yeah, wow, good on you. It's just so phenomenal. Last little thing I want to talk about, what was it like coming back and dry land and being in bed knowing you don't have to wake up the next day? What was it like to assimilate back into society and not be out on the water and use your legs again?
Yeah. Tricky. Like, I lost my wallet somewhere along the way. So I had no idea where my ID was, like my card. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to be a normal person again. How do I do this? And the one thing I fantasized about the whole time was sitting at Cafe on Hedges and having poached eggs on toast, which is a cafe across from us. And when I finally did that, I said, I just want to read the paper and sit there. And I did that. And it felt so surreal. It probably still felt like I was on the boat, but it felt so surreal. But it really did take that month or two to get used to it. And yeah, it was amazing to be able to share the journey. And it's really interesting. Instead of the record, people talking, they were talking about Gotcha for Life. And it sort of put it on the radar of so many people who had never spoken about, you know, mental fitness. So I would say everyone who donates is going on and investing because they're reading about what Gotcha for Life is. So that made me super excited, but it took a little while to get used to. When I first turned the television back on for the first time, I was like, wow, I don't even know what's happening. I missed like a year of music and shows and
news. You would have missed so much news cycle. About like, of COVID and stuff
news
like
cycle for like a month at a time. We came back and they were like, guys, like there's a war going on between Russia and Ukraine. It actually started a month ago because we'd been out of range for a month. And Shane Warne died and all this stuff. And it was 1 month prior. It was crazy.
Wow, it's just so wild. Well, like I said, congratulations. Thank you. Incredible to achieve a world record. Incredible to do something that not many have ever done on this planet. It's just like so special. I feel a privilege just to be able to sit here. It just seems so weird that at one stage in your timeline, your reality was out to sea hundreds of kilometers out, and right now we're just sitting in our safe little couch here.
I'm glad no crocodiles. Well, that I know. I probably think they see one at Stratty or something recently, right?
Yeah, North Stratty following crocodile.
Me. Yeah, that's not cool.
Yeah, you brought them around from the NT.
Hopefully not.
But far out, this has been such an eye-opening chat. I'm so grateful to share this room with you, to hear your story from someone in mental health. I just want to say thank you for the money that you raised for such an incredible charity like Gotcha for Life. What I want to touch on real quickly before we finish is, what's the plans now after achieving something so big? It would be so hard to come back and find your identity again, because there's obviously so much more to you than the world record and the paddle around Australia. So what does the future look like for you now?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And I've sort of sketched out the chapters of my book, and the last one is Don't Come Back to Nothing. And that's what I kind of told myself the whole time, because I'd been there and I'd done that and I'd raced and had a bad result and had nothing to come back to. And I knew after this, and I'd had warnings from people who did expeditions, have something lined up, and it lined up at Mermaid, where I got offered the job of head coach of the Nippers. And I was hesitant at the start. I thought, oh, I'm going to want to do these projects post paddle. But I said yes, and it's one of the best things I've ever done. The kids keep you on your toes. They're coming up to their state titles soon. What it also allows me to do is invest in the book and the documentary that we're going to make. So, you know, through social media, we sort of shared a bit of the journey, but there is so much footage we haven't shown, all of those things I touched on, and the writing process too. So hopefully end of the year for those projects. So I'm really excited putting everything into them, and a lot of research into, you know, the best ways to go about it, you know, publishing a book and all sorts of things. So that's a new challenge, and it'll be, yeah, really special to share the journey.
Well, I cannot wait. Hopefully Netflix or one of the big companies pick up the documentary so it can be seen far and wide, because like we touched on, probably like the scratching of not even a tiny bit of paint off the surface today. I'm sure there's so many stories in there, the ups and downs, the triumphs, the hard days, the easy days, and everything in between that are just going to blow everyone's mind. I can't wait to read the book and can't wait to watch the documentary too, because I'm sure there's some beautiful footage in there from all around the country, which is the country that we're very lucky to call home. But now I'm sure you have a very different perspective of how bloody big the thing is.
Absolutely. And there are so many beautiful parts too. You're right. There are some incredible. I would encourage anyone to get out there, see the country. It makes you so grateful and beautiful. It's, you know, the nature, natural wonders of the world. As I said, we didn't run into a whale shark, but maybe hopefully in the future.
Yeah, far out. I just am finding it so hard to comprehend what you've done. And there is a lot more things that I do want to talk about, like your dietitian work and stuff. But I reckon we're going to call it here today, because your story about this world record is just something so phenomenal. I guess the last thing I'll give you is just a bit of time to maybe thank anyone who really helped you on that journey, whether it be the sponsors that came on board, your team. Yeah, a little opportunity to thank them, because I'm sure the listeners will, yeah. I'm sure you'll want to thank and let the listeners know that there was more to the team, like you kept saying, we did this. So yeah, who do you want to thank? Who came on board to really support the journey?
Absolutely. There were times where the boys said, you know, say I don't know. It's naturally in me to say we. So my husband Matt, who, yeah, after those couple of weeks came on board, I would never have been able to do it without him. He organized everything from exemptions to where we were going to get fuel from in the middle of nowhere. Blake, Jamie and Ben were the three, my core crew that came the whole way around, and never once to their credit did they ever talk about backing down or quitting. They gave their time and everything they had into it, and they were put into some really scary situations. So certainly to them as well. And Shoreham Partners Financial Services came on board at the start, where they had no reason to believe in the project. They've done a lot to equal the opportunity for men and women within sport as well, and believed in this, believed in me, and believed in me as a female. And the last one would be Gotcha for Life and the incredible team there, Gus and his team, and you know, the emotional and mental support that they gave me throughout. And they talk about having a village of people around you, and you know, through those incredible people and my own immediate family, I did really have a village that got me through.
Yeah, wow. It's just like so cool to know the journey that you've been on, the people who shared that journey and the people who supported that journey, and that it all was around for mental health is just so special. So thank you so much for sharing your story. Thank you so much for inspiring so many, hopefully a lot of young women as well. Like you said, not only were you the fastest around the country, you're the fastest to do it as a woman too, which is just so incredible to inspire younger generations to go out there and chase those big, what seem unachievable goals. The last question I do finish every Good Humans podcast with is the same for every guest. And I'm going to ask you, what does being a good human mean to Bonnie Hancock?
It means thinking about others as well as yourself. It means investing in things that make you a better person, finding your passion and chasing it, and then using that to help others. So I'm very grateful in the opportunities that I've had. I've had others lift me up to get me where I am. And now I hope to help pull others up as well. So I think instead of putting people down, you pull others up and finding your passion, because I think that makes you a better person. And when you're a better person, have that positive outlook on the world, that spreads. It's that energy that spreads. So yeah, I was lucky to find my passion early, but everyone can find passions at all different times of their life. So find your passion. You're going to have that flow on effect.
Very beautifully put. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I guess last thing, where can anyone find you if they want to find you on socials, website? Yeah. I will leave it all in the show notes, but yeah, last little chance to let people know where they can find you.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, a lot of the videos and photos are on Instagram. So at Bonnie Hancock is the handle. It's the Paddle of Oz on Facebook, and we've got YouTube as well under Bonnie Hancock. So there's some of the things I've talked about, there's videos on there that the boys edited, and a lot more coming out at the end of the year.
Wow. Well, I can't wait. I will leave it all in the show notes. If you've enjoyed today's episode and you've been inspired by it, please do me a big favor. Tag both myself and Bonnie on an Instagram story, share it. I'm sure she would love to answer any questions if you've got any about that crazy paddle, or if you want to go on it yourself. As she said, she's happy to help people try and achieve those unachievable goals. So big thanks for jumping on Good Humans Podcast.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.